Hey, this is Tommy. This is the All-Star break for Major League Baseball, so I thought it might be nice to throw a little baseball here in the Southbound feed. So this week, we're replaying my conversation from last year with ESPN's Ryan McGee. Sports fans know him best these days from the radio and TV show Marty and McGee, which brings a deep Southern flavor to the airwaves. But when we talked, McGee had also just come out with a book about his adventures working for Minor League Baseball's Asheville Tourists. Ryan is a born storyteller, and man, does he have some stories. Y'all enjoy.
Someone got angry with someone else when they lined up to take this picture. The Spartanburg Phillies' tall head got in someone's way, and they shoved it aside. And the next thing you know, we're all sitting in the stands just waiting on them to take the picture so we can, you know, get our guy and get out of there. And my roommate, the great Carlton Adcock of Bristol, Tennessee, all of a sudden Carlton stands up and he goes, "The Spartanburg Phillies about to throw down."
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound, conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. That story you heard a second ago was part of Ryan McGee's tale of the great mascot brawl of 1994. One of the many wild things that he saw and sometimes did during his summer as an intern with the Asheville Tourists minor league baseball team. Ryan has captured those stories in a new book due out April 4th called Welcome to the Circus of Baseball. McGee is best known these days as the co-host of the SEC Network show Marty and McGee, where he and Marty Smith might talk about anything from Saturday's big college football games to the world's dumbest crooks. McGee also spent years covering NASCAR and is a regular at the College Baseball World Series in Omaha. He was one of the first regular ESPN on-air personalities to have a strong Southern accent, and he talks about those early days of standing out from the crowd. But mostly, we talk about the joys of minor league baseball and the occasional horror of having to fill the Dairy Queen machine. Here's our conversation. This book, among other things, is sort of a love letter to minor league baseball, and it sounds like, from what you say in the book, that your family sort of had that love way before you got this job.
Oh yeah, I mean, it was, you know, we didn't have major league sports, and I'm talking about the 70s and 80s and even the 90s. You know, the Panthers weren't around in Charlotte yet, and the Hornets were, you know, didn't come around until I was in high school. And so, and you had the Braves in Atlanta. But, you know, I grew up all over North Carolina. Unless the church youth group decided we're going to have a trip to see the Braves this weekend, or your family took a vacation and went to Atlanta for a few days, that you didn't go. And I grew up in a baseball house. But if you were going to go to a baseball game, where I grew up, and I was born in Rockingham, North Carolina, lived in Shelby, lived in Raleigh, lived in Greenville, South Carolina before it was cool. And, you know, we had minor league baseball teams in almost all of those towns. And if we got tired of going to games, you know, in Durham or in Greenville, or, you know, even the old Shelby Pirates where we lived when I was in elementary school, within 90 minutes, 2 hours, 3 hours, you could get to all of these minor league ballparks. And so that's what my family kind of collected minor league ballparks. Even when I was a little kid, I still do. I still plan my travel around, you know, when I'm trying to travel in the summertime, the first thing I do is I get the minor league baseball schedule out because I'm trying to hit a ballpark I've never been to. So yeah, that was the house I grew up in. And we would raid everything. You know, if we drove from, you know, Raleigh to Fayetteville to go see the Fayetteville Generals, and on the way home, my dad, my mom, my brother, and myself, we would rate the hot dogs and we would rate the music they played.
Do you remember the best ballpark hot dog you ever had?
They used to, in Durham, you know, you had if you ever seen Bull Durham, the old Durham Bulls ballpark, and that great shot where they walk in the Cathedral Baseball, that's exactly what it looked like. I mean, and that's when we lived there. I mean, we were living in Raleigh at the time, but there was an old guy who grilled hot dogs, and it was down the right field line. You know, there's like an old tobacco warehouse down the right field line, and you parked in a gravel lot. In the movie, that's where the bus drops the players off, and there was a guy down there, and he was not he wasn't boiling hot dogs. They weren't floating in water. He was down there grilling hot dogs. He'd burn them. And I like my hot dogs a little too well done. And so he would burn them, and he would heat the buns. His first time I ever saw would open the bun, set it down, and grill it. That was the best ballpark hot dog I ever had. It was the closest I could find to, some of the legendary, triad hot dogs that you could find, in some off the road joints. That was the closest I ever found in an actual ballpark.
All right, so let's just set the scene for this book. It's 1994. You're a summer intern with the Asheville Tourists. How much money were you making, and what did you have to do for that money?
I was making $100 a week, cash. I did find a pay stub recently. Bless my wife's heart. I never throw anything away, which is great when you're trying to write a book and trying to remember stuff. But I mean, just folders and boxes full of stuff that everywhere I've ever been. And so I did find a pay stub. So at some point they did cut checks. But what I remember is being handed $100 bill, every Friday. Isn't it funny, man? You reach a certain age and, we're both fortunate to have been doing what we're doing for a long time, probably making a little more money than we ever expected to make doing what we're doing. And, but I don't think I was ever happier than I was when I made $100 a week. And I don't know how we had to be very creative to eat. We had to be very creative to put gas in the car. We had to be super creative to pay rent. But we made it work. And I don't remember being super stressed out about it until the trick was not to step too far away from your routine that you set up. Like when I finally decided to take a girl on a date, I took her to the Grove Park Inn to eat on the Sunset Terrace off the back. What an idiot. Dinner cost
Grove Park Inn, one of the ritziest hotels in America.
Oh yeah. I mean, I decided I'm going to take this date to, where F. Scott Fitzgerald used to live. Right. And this is a great Gatsby place. And I remember having to call my roommate, and this is before cell phones and text or whatever else. I call the apartment and leave a message on the answer machine. Dude, I got no money. I'm gonna have to wash dishes. They're gonna throw me in jail. And I remember the hostess coming to me. I'm stalling, right? We're eating dinner, and this girl's ordered like $75 worth of food, and I'm drinking water. And I'm sitting there stalling, and just hoping that my roommate Carlton Adcock, another intern, shows up. And sure enough, the hostess comes and says, "Miss McGee, you have a phone call at the hostess stand." And I walk up there, and there's Carlton standing there in the Grove Park Inn lobby with flip-flops and a t-shirt. And he goes, "What the hell were you thinking, man?" And he'd gotten some money out of the ATM. So yeah, you figured out how to make it work. But $100 a week, I don't remember feeling poor, but I was 100% poor.
So what did you do for that $100 a week?
It was everything. We were handed literally the first day on the job, you were handed a sheet of ballpark duties. And there were essentially three interns, and we each made $100. All three of us had just graduated college, and you had your list, and you would spend 1 month, you rotate jobs. 1 month, you're the concessions intern. Well, you got to heat up the chili, and you got to make sure there's enough ice frozen for the snow cone stand, and you got to mix the sugar juice to go into the snow cone stand, and you got to set up the Dairy Queen machine, and you got to mop the floor and all those things. And then the office intern, you're selling tickets during the day in the ticket office, and you're running copies, and you're making sure the Colorado Rockies or parent ball club had the stats they needed that day. And, you're answering the phones. And then the third intern is kind of this, you're in the ballpark, right? And you're taking care of the press box, and you're making sure the box seat patrons are okay. But at the end of the day, every column had a list of job duties depending on which month you were in. But at the bottom in bold print, it just said TARP. So it didn't matter what your job was, if you were the general manager and president of the team, or if you were been cooking hot dogs down in the grandstand all day, if it started raining, it was all hands on deck to pull the tarp. And the tarp was my mortal enemy throughout the entirety of the summer.
It sounds like it sent you flying at least once, right?
Yeah, no, it did. So when you watch a Major League Baseball game and you see them pull the tarp, they got about 100 people out there, and it looks like a silk bed sheet, being spread on a 5-star hotel bed. It's beautiful. Air goes underneath it just right, and it puffs and it falls on the bed. When you have 100 people, that's what a tarp pull looks like. When you have 6 people, the tarp pull becomes a tarp drag, because if it starts raining hard enough, as it will do on a July evening, in the mountains, the water starts to collect, and you don't have enough muscle. and that thing starts dragging. And yeah, one night we had a god awful thunderstorm that came in, and McCormick Field, the home of the Asheville Tourists, is carved into the side of a mountain, and the wind would come down off that mountain like a wind tunnel, and it would pick up speed and come down through the ballpark. And we were pulling that tarp, and at the time, this is not the case anymore, but at the time I weighed about 120 pounds, and the wind came off that mountain and went underneath the tarp, and I literally felt it go between my legs. We all did. And you're running, and you're, so you got a hold of this like nylon handle, and you're running with as much speed as you can get. And that wind went underneath me, got up underneath that polyurethane tarp, and I felt my feet come up off the ground. And there's a point, Tommy, where you have to decide as you rise above earth, do I let go or do I ride this out and hope that it sets me down? And in my mind, I went about 150 feet up in the air. Eyewitnesses have told me it's probably about 6 or 7 feet. And in my mind, I stuck the landing, right? When I let go, I look like, you know, Captain America and Winter Soldier. Like I'm feet down, you know, fingers down, you know, I'm ready to go. The reality was, I think what I wrote in the book was I looked like I was a no longer needed hostage, you know, thrown out of a moving van. Like I crashed into the dugout. I remember my hands were shaking. And the manager, we're playing the Hickory Crawdads. And the manager of the Hickory Crawdads, a guy named Fred Kendall, who played in the big leagues forever. His son, Jason, played in big leagues forever. And Kendall was sitting there. And he goes, "You all right?" I said, "Coach, I think I'm okay." And he said, "You got some pretty good airtime." And I said, "Thanks." And then he told me a story about when he was playing, I think, for the Padres, Wrigley Field, watching three or four guys get thrown up in the air. So I felt better. But, yeah, that tarp, I always say that tarp was like the – in Home Alone, the furnace in the basement that kind of like scares Kevin to death. Kevin, that's how I felt like the tarp was taunting me every day when I got to work.
You mentioned, as you were talking about the list of duties, was filling the Dairy Queen machine.
Yeah.
And, you tell a story in this book about, an incident that you had with that. Could you tell that story real quick?
The Dairy Queen machine, and I'm a Dairy Queen aficionado, man. You talking about these road trips with the family. We never went anywhere without somebody screaming, "It's Dairy Queen, it's Dairy Queen," you know, pull over. But to make that amazing soft serve ice cream, you have this super incredibly super sweet, like milk mix is what it looks like. And there's no telling what all is in there. But it was all in this bladder. I mean, it's like a plastic, almost like a clear trash bag. And it was in a box. What I know now is you're supposed to pick up the whole box, and you had to get up to the top of the machine. And then you would, you know, there's a nozzle, and you pour this white stuff into this machine, you let it churn, and this milky mix turns into the greatest ice cream of all time. Well, I took the bag out of the box, which I've been told now was the wrong approach. I get up on a step ladder. And maybe two or three steps up, just a little shop ladder. And I get up to the top, and it's like a body bag full of water is what I've got on my shoulder. And there was a little nozzle on there that you're supposed to, you know, connect to this hole at the top of the Dairy Queen machine. And I, in my genius, decided, all right, I'm going to loosen this thing up, this little nozzle, before I get up there so that I'm not awkwardly on a ladder holding the bag, you know, loosening the nozzle and connecting it to the spout or whatever. Well, that was a mistake, because as I boosted that thing up off my shoulder and I went up on the ladder, the corner of that nozzle, you know, hit the corner of the machine, and a little white spray started spraying out, this white stuff. And the compression of the bag on my shoulder, it's like a bagpipe, you know, it's the air. I'm just pushing this stuff out. So now it's spraying against the wall. So instead of just waiting it out and letting the stuff spray as much as it's going to spray up against the wall, onto the floor, into the drain, you know, I'm going to try to fix this. I give it one more boost. And when I do, this stuff is getting all over me and my shoes and the ladder. And I mean, everything just let go all at once. Like whatever friction was holding us together stopped. And I went, I went ass over ice cream, and I landed down on the floor. And this stuff is all over me. I land in a puddle of it on the floor, just flat on my back, just smack, straight on my back. I'm laying there thinking, all right, this can't get any more humiliating. I realize that Jane, who runs concessions, is on the phone down the hallway in her office. She has no idea this has happened. Right about the time I thought, okay, I think I can save this, I heard what sounded like a suck and then like a pop. And I realized whatever was holding the rest of that bag on the top of the machine let go. And that bag landed on my face and just poured all the rest of it all over me. And so now I'm laying in the floor. So I walk over the door. I make sure that Jane, the boss, still doesn't have any idea. And there was a cat, Julio, the ballpark. I call the cat in there, and the cat's in there licking up stuff, and I'm hosing it down.
Greatest day of the cat's life.
Greatest day of the cat's life. And I'm like, Julio, get in here. And Julio, I named the ballpark cat Julio. It's just this feral cat. Julio's licking up milky white Dairy Queen mix. And I realize, all right, the coast is clear. I run to the clubhouse. Team's not there yet. I take off all my clothes, and I throw them in the dryer. And I'm thinking, I'm going to pull this off. No one is going to have any idea what happened. They just think I just cleaned the Dairy Queen booth. And I'm standing there naked, which, as you know, Louis Grizzard said, naked means you don't have your clothes on, you're up to something. Naked, you don't have your clothes on. I'm totally naked. And I'm standing there waiting on the clothes to dry, and our pitching coach, Jack LeMay, who pitched in the big leagues forever, all of a sudden he called me Glasses. He goes, Glasses, you all right? And I turn around, I said, yeah, coach, I had a little problem with the Dairy Queen machine. He goes, well, just so you know, this looks pretty effed up right here. I go, okay, coach. So, yeah, no, the Dairy Queen machine did not be out. But I have since learned, as I've told this story, I've since learned from multiple, at least one Dairy Queen executive and multiple people who worked in the Dairy Queen booth, that the problem was me. Everything I did in that whole thing was wrong, and I certainly paid the price for it.
Part of what makes this book so great, man, and part of what makes minor league baseball so great is all these characters you kind of run across. And there's some regulars at the ballpark that are sort of fascinating people to me. The one who sort of fascinated me the most, I guess, was the guy who would come and go behind the fence and get the old baseballs.
Yeah.
Could you sort of describe who he was and kind of what he was doing back there?
Well, James the Mountain Man is who you're talking about. And the first time I saw James, I thought he was breaking into the ballpark. You know, we're getting ready for a game, and all of a sudden this guy, and he's bald, he's got no shirt on, but he's got the denim overalls on and his boots, and he's going in the service gate. Like, he's going back there where they come in to get the dumpsters. And I'm like, who the hell is this guy? And I start to flag him down, and Gary Saunders, who is the assistant GM, one of my bosses, Gary's like, no, leave him alone, that's James. And he's like, hey, James. And James like, hey. And that's all he said. He went behind the fence. And McCormick Field is carved into the side of a mountain, and you got the outfield fence. And then it's kudzu and honeysuckle. And I mean, it's a jungle back there. And he just disappears. And I'm like, where is he going? And I realize batting practice is happening. And these guys are hitting balls over the fence into this jungle back there. And Ron McKee, who was my boss of the tourists, had known James forever. And he paid James a quarter for every baseball that he would bring back from behind that wall, because he's trying to save money. Baseballs are super expensive. I didn't know that until I worked in baseball. Baseballs are really expensive. And so James' job was to collect baseballs, and depending on what condition they were in, he might get 50 cents, he might get a quarter. But James would come back with this canvas bag, and it'd be full of baseballs of all, you know, varying degrees of shades of, you know, white or brown. But I remember one time James came out, and I said, well, James, how we do? And he's pretty good. And he held up his arm, and there was a damn snake, like, hanging off of his arm. And I was like, and I thought, well, that snake's wrapped around his arm. And that snake was, he had his fangs in. Like, he was hanging off of James, like, with his teeth dug in. I go, James, there's a damn snake. And he just like, oh, look here. And he just popped it off and, like, snapped his neck and threw it in the bag. And that was when I realized that there was another part of the agreement with the tourists, which was that whatever James found back there, he could eat. He could take it home. You know, the people in West North Carolina, these are my people, but they'll eat about anything if they can cook it. And so James, I mean, squirrels, possums, you know, snakes, whatever, James took them home and put them in a stew.
Well, beyond all the regulars, the folks who, you know, you saw all the time at the stadium, there would be these, you know, touring acts, the everybody who goes to the ballpark would have seen, folks like the San Diego Chicken, you know, who's kind of the most famous one of those. But you, right at the beginning of the book, talk about one that I somehow had never heard of or met. Could you please tell the story of Captain Dynamite?
Yeah, Captain Dynamite and his exploding coffin of death.
That's right.
And so when Captain Dynamite, so there's varying degrees, you know, of acts, ballpark acts. The good news is if you're running a minor league team, any act usually is a spike in attendance. The bad news is you can't afford to book the San Diego Chicken every week. So you go looking for ones that there's different tiers. So like there was a Blues Brothers act that cost a couple thousand dollars. We couldn't afford to bring them in a couple times a year, but we could bring them in once. But then to counter that, sometimes you settled for Captain Dynamite and Exploding Coffin of Death. And this guy, he did this for decades. And I mean, at drag strips and county fairs and Major League Baseball games. I mean, there was, I found a story written up about him that was in the New York Times back in the 1970s. But he would roll up in a station wagon. I think we paid him $500 in cash. And he had a woman with him that I said looked like she came from an Andrew Wyeth painting. Looked like the woman in the field, right? Is she running from the house or going to the house? What she looked like? Very weathered. And then there was a bunch of little kids. And that was his crew. Because we asked, part of our job as interns, we would help set up, you know, whatever the guests needed. And it was like contract riders and also he didn't have any of that. He just showed up and they constructed right behind second base. I mean, the same second base where, you know, Jackie Robinson had played. And they would build this rudimentary coffin, which was really just a bunch of 3M insulation, you know, foam panels painted somewhat black. And they put it out right behind it. It looked like a coffin out there. And they'd pack it full of dynamite. Like Wile E. Coyote, like old school, like dynamite, right? It's red sticks with the, you know, fuses on them and everything. And they packed that in there. And Captain Dynamite put on this old, like, coverall. Yeah, I would call it a fire suit, like from NASCAR, but it wasn't that nice. And it had, like, you know, Captain Dynamite sewn into the letters and, like, an old bomb on it and stuff. And he crawls up into this coffin. And they literally had the old, like you see in the movies, like the old T-handled, you know, detonator.
Like the plunger, yeah, where the Wile E. Coyote used, yeah.
That's it. Exactly right. Like he's going to blow up the bridge and finally get the Roadrunner. So the family, they wire this thing up and they put him in there to put the lid on it and they take this thing over. Well, now it's getting tense because now we, and Ron, my boss, isn't worried about it. He's booked this guy before, but the rest of us are like, the hell's going on? And we get down the dugout at McCormick Field is kind of below ground level. We all get in there like a bunker and the players start, this is before the game, the players start coming in, like they're going to see what's going on. And we had this great old PA announcer, Sam Zurich, who, if you grew up in the Carolinas, Sam voiced every TV commercial forever. And Sam was retired, living in Asheville. And he starts doing the countdown. There were like players started handing out batting helmets in the dugout, like, you know, in case any body parts came flying in. And that thing went off, Tommy. I mean, it was like, it was concussive. Like it was stunning. It was so loud. And it was a literal mushroom cloud, you know, went up over second base. And now, all these little silver and pink and black foam things are coming to the ground. And once the smoke kind of clears, he's just laying there. Just like in a fetal position, he's out. And the family goes running out there. And I don't know, it could have been smelling salt. She could have just clapped her hands or shaken him or whatever. But eventually he kind of came to and stood up and maybe he was acting and maybe I fell for it, but I swear I wasn't that far away from him. I thought he was dead. And that the quote we start the book with was from one of the tour's players. Oh man, I think that some bitch is actually dead, and we all really believed it. And because there was a moment where the crowd was horrified, and then it was kind of Evel Knievel-esque, like is he dead? And then once you realize he's not, they start cheering. But what I always remember is he put his arm around his wife's shoulders, and they're walking off the field. And now we got to run out here and clean this thing up before the ball game starts. Usually he would do it after the game, but this day we did it before the game. And I remember leaving and I said to him, I said, hey, great job. He kind of looked at me and like, what? And she goes, he said, great job. And that's when I realized he couldn't hear. He had a glass eye, missing fingers, but you know, it was off. And then that was his retirement year. And then he was actually in the process of training a lady dynamite who she's on YouTube if you find her. And she was young and she was very, I'll just say she was very 1994. She looked like the ladies on the Budweiser poster that everybody had in their dorm room, you know, back in the 90s. And she had a thong anchored version of what he had worn. And she did it forever. She's retired in Florida now. So yeah, Captain Dynamite. If you can't get the San Diego Chicken, by God, you can get Captain Dynamite and scare everybody to death.
Right. I could have you tell these stories for 10 hours here, and that would be a great thing for me. I do want to get to one more, though. This is another incident that I had never heard about, but should have, for living in North Carolina for a long time. Could you please tell the story of what you call the Battle of Hickory?
As with all great historic moments and conflicts, as the book has started to get out there among the minor league baseball people, there's some dispute about what actually went down and what we all remember. I know what I remember. And what I remember is the Hickory Crawdads were a brand new minor league baseball team and were a national sensation. They were kind of at the leading edge of what we call mascot mania. You know, they had this awesome logo, and they're pre-internet, right? They're selling hats all around the world. You see pictures of people wearing Hickory. I remember being in Europe and seeing a guy with a Hickory Crawdads hat on in Venice. You know, they were everywhere. And so they landed the South Atlantic League, the Sally League All-Star Game in 1994. And instead of just playing the game, they turned it into a week-long thing. And part of the festivities were the night before the actual game. It was like a home run derby and an all-star game. And, you know, Gaylord Perry was there. And, you know, they brought back all the old legends. They decided they're going to bring all the mascots of the South Atlantic League onto the field for a photo op. And that includes Ted E. Tourist, who was our mascot from the Tourists, and the Hagerstown Sun, and the Albany Polecat, and, you know, from all over the South Atlantic League. That included Conrad the Crawdad, the Hickory Crawdad. And Conrad, his outfit was very aggressive. It was not very mobile, you know. So he had what was essentially like a spandex skirt on with a tail on it. So he couldn't really walk that well. His ankles were essentially tied together. And his hands were in these big foam claws, which is great for waving, but you can't function. So you kind of had two different types of mascots. You had the mascots that were just people in baseball uniforms with a big head on. I remember the Spartanburg Philly was just a guy in a uniform, but had a giant horse head. It looked like a road cone. So you had these people with normal bodies and big heads. And then you had the people like Conrad who were completely constricted. Like there wasn't a lot of actual human, you know, body usage. Someone got angry with someone else when they lined up to take this picture. The Spartanburg Philly's tall head got in someone's way and they shoved it aside. And the next thing you know, we're all sitting in the stands just waiting on them to take the picture so we can, you know, get our guy and get out of there. And my roommate, the great Carlton Adcock of Bristol, Tennessee, all of a sudden Carlton stands up and he goes, "The Spartanburg Philly's about to throw down." And we realize this thing is built and built and built. And it's 150 degrees and they're all in these uniforms, these costumes. And sure enough, a shoving match starts. And it was this contrast of you had the people who had all this mobility, they're ready to go. I mean, there's double goozles going on. They're ready to go. And then you got the ones who are constricted. They're just trying to get the hell out of there. And next thing you know, it all lasted probably a grand total of 10 seconds. It took me about 25 pages to explain it. You had a furry hand over here and you had a tail that had been ripped off over there. And it, I mean, the debris field was large at LP Franz Stadium. And so, yeah, the Battle of Hickory, it goes down a legend. And that night, one of my coworkers had a friend that was working in Hickory, and we all got in a Jeep and went around to all these kind of speakeasies and roadhouses around Hickory and around Newton. And we ended up in this cinder block roadhouse. I mean, looked like the Double Deuce, right, from Roadhouse. And we go in there, and I go to the bar to order a beer, and Minnie Minoso is sitting at the bar. He was one of these legends that had come in, and he was so drunk. And I got him to sign my ticket stub that I still had in my pocket from the festivities that night. And I'll never forget it. He signed. I still have the ticket. There's a photo of it in the book. You can barely read that it says Minnie Minoso. I just remember he handed me the ticket back. He goes, "Were you at the ballpark?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "How about that damn mascot fight?"
When we come back, Ryan McGee talks about how his NASCAR knowledge helped him get a foothold at ESPN.
The line of people waiting to work on college football was from, you know, my house back to Raleigh. the line of people waiting to work on NASCAR was one person, and that was me.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Ryan McGee. You've done a bunch of different stuff. So you've done a lot of NASCAR, you've done a lot of college football, you've done a lot of college baseball. You have this show, Marty and McGee, now. It's become kind of this phenomenon. When you run into people on the street, is there anything in particular they recognize you from?
It's Marty McGee. Yeah, it's funny because it used to be, what I always said is that Marty's famous, and I am adjacently recognizable, right? My daughter refers to me as contextually famous. So, you know, if we're in Oxford, Mississippi, to do Marty McGee on the Saturday morning, you know, of the Egg Bowl, then, you know, people probably might recognize me, you know, on the square in Oxford. You know, people recognize Marty everywhere he goes. So I kind of dig, you know, my role in the deal, but it's Marty McGee. But it used to be a very specific, like, I used to say, if someone recognized me at the airport in 2015, they were a super hardcore NASCAR fan. And because that's, you know, motorsports, that's what I was covering primarily. And then as the years went on and I was just basically writing and doing a little bit of radio and TV, if I got recognized at the airport in Madison, Wisconsin, they were a super concentrated, hardcore college football fan, you know, or in Omaha, Nebraska, they might know me from the College World Series. But yeah, with Marty McGee, it's been interesting because, you can't manufacture chemistry. You know, you either friends with someone or you aren't. And, you know, I was a television producer the first half of my career, and you would take really talented people and put them on a television set together, and it wouldn't work because the chemistry just didn't work. And with Marty and McGee, we've been friends for 20 plus years. You know, the idea of our show literally was born from the two of us driving up to Martinsville Speedway one Sunday morning at 6 o'clock in the morning and laughing and being like, man, I think people might dig this, like if we put it on the radio.
So for people who may not have heard or seen Marty and McGee, do you have like a 30-second, here's what this show is?
It's two guys talking sports and sometimes not talking sports, as our bosses will remind us on occasion. But it's just, it's us talking about everything from motorsports to college football to March Madness to whatever. And relating to it, you know, how do we react to it? I mean, I'm wearing an old Charlotte Coliseum t-shirt right now. Well, Marty McGee, we might talk about LeBron, you know, scoring 39 the night before, but we're probably going to talk about, man, we missed the Charlotte Coliseum, right? And so it's just two guys with Southern accents talking sports.
So was it hard to convince people at ESPN to let y'all do this?
You know, it wasn't. And that part of it is that always shocks people because When I went to ESPN, I kind of have two ESPN careers. You know, in the book, as you know, Welcome to Circus Baseball, it starts with my very poorly executed job interview at ESPN right out of college for an entry-level production assistant job. And then the book ends, and this is no spoiler here, it's the way it is. The book ends with me leaving Asheville and going to Bristol, Connecticut to start my job with ESPN. My first go around at ESPN, I mean, my dream was to talk about college football and maybe be on TV one day. And when I got to ESPN, Bristol, Connecticut in the mid-90s, the only person with a Southern accent in the entirety of the worldwide leader in sports with me. You know, Reese Davis at this point had already scrubbed his Muscle Shoals dialect. Stu Scott was from Greensboro, was claiming to be from Brooklyn at this point. And it was me. I mean, I was the only one that sounded like this. And so I tell Jeff Gordon all the time, I owe him everything, because literally the month I started ESPN, Jeff Gordon won the inaugural Brickyard 400 at Indianapolis, and suddenly NASCAR was cool. And the line of people waiting to work on college football was from, you know, my house back to Raleigh. The line of people waiting to work on NASCAR was one person, and that was me. And I was from, when they found out I was born in Rockingham, and I kind of knew what, you know, around the wedge meant, suddenly, you know, that was my, and it got me moved back to Charlotte 2 years later. I say all that to say this. There was still a little part of me that thought, because they treated me like a foreign exchange student when I first moved to Bristol, that us going to the radio and podcast department and saying, can Marty and I talk about, you know, Buckshot Jones for an hour and you record it? I thought the answer would have been not a chance, but they said yes immediately. And it started off as a podcast that no one listened to, that we recorded at the ESPN radio affiliate in Charlotte. And then we started doing a mid Saturday time slot, like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that no one listened to, but eventually we moved to Saturday morning. And then eventually they also put it on television. And so, literally, Tommy, no exaggeration, after every show, Marty and I walk out into the parking lot of the Wilderness Lodge Studios in Charlotte, and Marty looks at me, and I look at him, and I go, do you think they're going to let us do it again next week?
So you talked about getting your start with ESPN doing NASCAR stuff. And you talked about being there in sort of the sweet spot when Jeff Gordon and Dale Earnhardt, Dale Jr., all those racers, at the time when NASCAR was sort of at its peak. It's obviously not there right now. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on, is there some way to sort of get that mojo back?
It's getting better. I mean, I'll say this. It was 6-7 years ago, it was bleak. I mean, like bleak, like the garage was a depressing place to be. You know, I went from, back in the day, I'd go to 25 races a year. I went from that to, you know, 6-7 years ago, I was going to the racetrack 7-8 times a year. And I got to where I didn't want to do it, because when you went into the garage, every conversation was about what's wrong. And every conversation was about how can we get it back? It's never going to get back to where it was in 2002. It's just not. It's not the way the world works anymore. Baseball is never going to get back to where it was, you know, in 1992. It's just how it is. But it's so much better now, and it's so much more positive now in the garage than it was then. And it really started a year ago. You know, there's a new car. There's a bunch of new, young, cool drivers. You know, we're about to enter a period where guys are going to start retiring. You know, the guys that were the youngsters for me, you know, Kevin Harvick and, you know, Brad Keselowski and these guys, they're all going to be retiring. Denny Hamlin will be retiring over the next several years. And so there's this transition coming. But these guys now are, if they'll let themselves be themselves, if Chase Elliott will cut loose just a little bit, and if Ryan Blaney will cut loose just a little bit, and these guys will really show themselves and not let the sponsors and the bosses tell them to, you know, wear a white dress shirt all the time, they're every bit as cool and in a lot of ways more talented than the legends, you know, that we talk about from the 80s and the 90s. And so there's a lot of potential there. And there's also willingness to try stuff. I mean, this year they're going back to North Wilkesboro, Tommy. There's,
I know.
If you'd have told me that, I mean, you're talking to a bitter Rockingham kid, right? I mean, that Rockingham's just sitting there, you know, returning to the earth, as Bruton Smith once said about North Wilkesboro. And now Bruton's son, Marcus, is waking that track up. You know, I'm going up there next week. And so it's, and they're trying a street course in downtown Chicago. And, you know, the last 2 years they've run, you know, what we used to call the Busch Clash, you know, the Budweiser Shootout, whatever, the preseason All-Star race, they run it in the LA Coliseum. They build a racetrack on top of the football field.
Yeah, it does feel like they're trying stuff now.
That's it. And they've been putting dirt, they're covering Bristol Motor Speedway in dirt right now as we speak. And so there's a willingness now to take your cuts. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You know, okay, fine. But just going back to places twice a year and every race weekend's 4 days and starting the season in February, ending at Thanksgiving, because that's how we've always done it. You know, that's how you die.
I don't want to get out of here. We're talking about the bottom 10.
Yeah.
which is your weekly piece during college football season where you rank the worst 10 teams in the country. And the question I've had about that ever since you've done it is, do more people complain to you about their team being in the bottom 10 or out of the bottom 10?
You know, it's probably 50-50. What's interesting is, so the coveted fifth spot, the most misunderstood aspect of the bottom 10, the coveted fifth spot is reserved for a really good team who had a shockingly bad weekend. You know, if Alabama loses to Texas A&M, you know, I might put them in the coveted fifth spot. Or, you know, if Tennessee's favored by two touchdowns against someone and they lose that game, then I'm probably going to put them in the coveted fifth spot. Those fan bases never understand that. Like, they get so angry. I still get angry emails about them. I put Miami in the coveted fifth spot 10 years ago. They still get mad about it. But I do get a lot of, I call it hashtag bottom 10 lobbying. And I always post that during the week. You know, I hear from a lot of people like, man, there's no way we cannot be in the bottom 10 this weekend. And so I hope that people understand it's never been mean-spirited, never supposed to be. We don't ever call players out by name. You know, we might mention an awful punt, but we won't say punter so-and-so did so-and-so. We don't pick on kids. But what's been interesting is the best part are the teams that have been in it for years. Like, all right, Georgia State, down in your homeland. Georgia State was my first ever bottom 10 champion, the first year I did it. Now they go to bowl games about every year. And that's the coolest thing to me. You know, when the UT San Antonio Roadrunners should have gone undefeated 2 years ago. I think they finished the season like 12-1. The year before, they won like one game and they've been in the bottom 10 forever. I call them ROCK in the UTSA. And but that's the best part. The best part is when the teams turn it around. Cause I feel like I'm with them, man. I feel like, you know, it's like sending your kids off to college. You know, I've been writing about Rice for 7 years and all of a sudden they win 8 games and go to a bowl game. That's a win for us, man. And so, yeah, but you'll appreciate this. I have worked on big journalistic projects that I'm so proud of. And we'll work on them for months and interview, you know, dozens of people and you know, calling lawyers and court documents, all sorts of stuff, and no one reads it. And then Captain Morgan and I will write the bottom 10 in about an hour and 15 minutes on Monday night. And you know, and it's the most trafficked thing that I do. So,
all right, one last thing. At the very beginning of this book, you know, you've done now so much. You've been to so many places. You've done so many different things. But at the beginning of this book, you talk about that your desire back when you were just coming out of college in the 90s was to do play-by-play. And I wonder if that's an itch that you still want to scratch at some point.
No, I'm good. Cause I'm terrible. I tried it. So I right out of college, and you know this, my father was the president at Wingate University outside of Charlotte for years, Division II, great Division II football program.
And a college football ref.
And he was college football official. Yeah. We wrote a book a couple years ago about that. And I got a job that paid no money. I had a bunch of jobs. The first fall that I lived at home, much to my parents' chagrin after graduation, because I, you know, we're in a recession. I couldn't find a job. I was a little too picky about my jobs anyway. WIXE, 1190 AM, Wixie and Dixie, in Monroe, North Carolina. James Fox Reddish, Fox with two X's. And Fox was a classic, still is classic AM radio, you know, Southern guy. And we would do Forest Hills Yellow Jackets high school football on Friday night. And I was the analyst. Because, you know, I played zero downs in football in my life. And then on Saturdays, I would help Fox with Wingate University football. And sometimes Fox wouldn't show up for work. And so I would do play-by-play. And I think Fox, looking back, did that for me on purpose. I go back and listen to those tapes now. In fact, we played a recording on Marty McGee that we found an old cassette tape of mine of me doing football. And Marty's like, "Who? That doesn't even sound like you." And I'm trying to do it from deep in my former ear and the Bulldogs. I'm trying to sound like Woody Durham, probably, you know, and it's not working. But I did one inning of baseball for the New Britain Red Sox for the one other team who offered me a job. When the tourists offered me the job, they did at the winter meetings in '93, and I was so excited to hear how I had done. And they actually did a replay on the radio as I was leaving the ballpark that night. And it was so bad. It was so awful. And so now when I watch my friends, you know, when I watch Tom Hart, you know, and I watch you know, Anish Shroff, and I watched, you know, all my friends that do play by play, and they're all so great at it. And I just am like, I couldn't have ever done that, ever. Southern accent or not, there was no, my brain could not process. You go watch Kevin Harlan call one of these NCAA tournament games, and I'm just like, I don't even deserve to be in the same building with that guy. So that itch has been scratched, and I think the world is much better off that I chose not to pursue that particular. If I had chosen to strictly pursue that avenue, then I would probably be the best, you know, corporate vice president, regional manager the Bank of America ever had.
I get this little twinge of Southern pride every time I see Ryan McGee on TV. And he's on TV a lot. He sounds like the South, North Carolina in particular. And it's still a sound you don't hear all that much from the folks who hold microphones and talk about sports. One thing that sports generates and enhances is a sense of identity. Fans wear their t-shirts and ball caps to represent their favorite team. And over a while, some of them start to think the team represents them too. It's one of those irrational but wonderful things that makes sports so enjoyable. Some folks forge their identity over hundreds of nights at a minor league ballpark, one of those places where the hot dogs have just the right char, and you don't care as much about the score as you do the beauty of a green ball field on a summer night. It can make a big world feel small and a small town feel big. More than anything, Ryan's book made me want to buy a ticket down the first base line at some little ballpark with a cold beer in hand, pondering the mysteries of the universe and the seventh inning stretch. It's some of the cheapest therapy you'll ever get.
This town ain't big, this town ain't small. It's a little of both, they say. Our ball club may be minor league, but at least it's triple A.
Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where every episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.